Well, we ready? Mm-hmm. We started with talking with Med Thring. I had met Thring when, during the war, I had gone to England on war research, and Thring at that time was working under Bennett, who was the head of BISRA, BCURA, British Coal Utilization Research Association. And Thring knew about a paper I had written on a meter for measuring heat flux in furnaces and wanted to talk about that, and he also knew about my work on radiation. So we had a long talk, and that's how I got to know Thring. So here I was back talking to the chief physicist of BISRA, who was now interested in this cooperative venture. Thring and their executive secretary, Elliot, and my wife and I left England and went to Holland and looked at the installation at IJmuiden, and went to a meeting of the Dutch committee at Delft, and I gave a lecture to the Dutch Physical Society, which was meeting that day in Delft, on radiation and measurement techniques. I forgot what all, but that was the, it was, I really told the physicist what I'd come to tell the flame crowd. And then we went on to Paris and met Professor Ribot, who was then the head of the international, was not called international yet, the head of the European Flame Committee. He was a professor at the Sorbonne and director of research of Gaz de France and head of the Laboratoire des Hautes Temperatures, the High Temperature Laboratory. I gave a lecture to a group in Paris on the same stuff I talked about in Delft. Riviere, whose father was high in, what's the French initials for their research? National Central something, SCNR, something like that. Anyway, Riviere's father was a high officer in that. Riviere was a young man. He later became, he's up near the top in IRCID now, in the French Metallurgical Institute. Anyway, he was my translator. I couldn't resist remembering about his later years. So I talked to the three groups, and I asked de Graaf if they wanted any American cooperation. And he smiled and he said, our three countries are just learning how to get along together on a cooperative research effort. And I think four would be too many as of now. That was the end of that. But the next year he came to America to give a paper to the Metallurgical Society. And I had him out to dinner, and we took him to the Boston Symphony. He said they had decided that they were ripe for American participation and would love to have us join them and make a contribution, of course, to the research work. So I told them I'd do what I could. I didn't do much in the next few months. And Ralph Sherman of Battelle Institute, Sherman had been with the Bureau of Mines before he went with Battelle, got talking with them and made a deal with them, which they didn't tell me about and he didn't tell me about, and caused real trouble later. I knew nothing about the deal. I just knew that Ralph Sherman and I were both interested in setting up an American committee. So we decided that we would both send out letters to people we knew in industry, members of corporations that ought to profit by this kind of activity. And I didn't send out many letters. I had very good success with my campaign. And our first meeting was in Columbus at Battelle Institute, at which meeting we organized a committee, and I was elected chairman of it. And we decided the next meeting would be at the Engineers Club in New York City. And at that meeting, I found out the financial arrangements that had been made between Battelle and the European group that kind of cast a shadow on my proselytizing for members. Well, I won't tell the whole story. Battelle resigned from the committee, and it looked as though the whole committee was going to break up for a while. But we did go on, and Battelle came back into the fold about 3 years later. And the committee survived and continued to send money, but didn't grow very much. By this time, the European thing had become the International Flame Foundation, a Dutch stichting. That's the name for some kind of a non-profit corporation. They were doing excellent work. I remember joining MedThring in interviewing people for the job of head of that at the time that John Baer was chosen. I was not among those who interviewed. I was not with Med when he interviewed Baer. I was with him when he interviewed an Australian who, 20 years later, when I was teaching at Newcastle in Australia, met me in Sydney and reminded me that I had helped pass on him way back when he graduated from Sheffield. I had forgotten about him. I was chairman of the Flame Committee for the first 20 years or so. And in 1972, said I was getting along and they needed somebody who was better at driving for new members. And Jim Hovis of Bloom Engineering Company became the very good president of the American Committee, and I was elected honorary chairman and still am the honorary chairman of that committee. The committee is now headed by one of our chem engineering graduates, Jordan Loftus, who's doing a superb job of building the American Flame Committee up into quite a well-known organization with a good reputation. It has a better reputation than when I was chairman of it. But I did get it going.
I'm wondering... I was going to comment about the work after your formal retirement in 1968. You published about one-third of all your papers after that time.
Well,
but you've got
not,
into...
Surely not. I published an occasional paper, but they get more and more infrequent. MIT's, at that time, 65 was the retirement age, and MIT had a system in which if both MIT and the professor wished it, he would stay on at half time at a salary frozen as of the year of his retirement. 68 was when the when things went that way. I started to go that way. And so I was halftime to 73, still teaching a graduate course in combustion or in radiative transfer until 73. But I, from 68 on, said to any student who came in and wanted to talk about doctor's thesis work that I was no longer offering theses, that it was improper to capitalize on a reputation you acquire over the years in competition with young people, and the thing to do was bow out. I'd be on advisory committees, but not the thesis supervisor. I had to tell that story for quite a few years, and finally it got around, so it's been some years before since I've had to tell anybody. No, they don't ask anymore.
In 1971, you did some work with Howard. You had a book on new energy technology.
Oh, yes. I had started into my retirement when Ray Baddour, then our department head, took a subcontract. Goodness, who had the main contract? What do you know? I forget who had the main contract. But we were to take a subcontract. We and two others were to take a subcontract on the energy, on a kind of an evaluation of the energy situation. And it was to, a deadline date was set. Then Ray Baddour called Glenn Williams and me in and said, you two are energy people in the department, who should I get to head this contract? And I said Jack Howard, and Glenn agreed thoroughly. We had the same high view of Jack, who'd done his thesis at Penn State and had come with us as an instructor, postdoctoral instructor. And I said, but he's young, and he would be helped out by contact with somebody older who knows some of the people he'll have to see, and I would be happy as a half-retired person to put a little time on that project, supporting Jack. And Ray said, that's grand, we'll do it that way. And so Jack had the was director of the contract, of the subcontract, but I was with him on it. And the more we worked on it, the more interested I got, and we decided that the material we had could be put into a book form, and that's what we better do. And we did. When we were ready to turn in our report, one of three that we're supposed to report on the energy situation to the main contractor, we were the only one of three who had a report ready. Jack and I had written ours in book form, because as we started to write it, we said, we'd just write this as the book we're going to write. And I did a lot of the writing. Jack did his full share, but I did a lot of rewriting. We were annoyed when the main contractor said, well, I want to hold this off until we get the other two. And I had told them that we plan to publish it as a separate book of our own, our part, and did they want acknowledgement of having had anything to do with it? Yes, they did. But would I please hold off submitting it until they had the other two contracts? Well, we waited a few months and got pretty tired, and finally I said, I'm calling. This time I'm not asking you if we may. I'm telling you that we're going to publish a book, and the only question I'm asking you is whether you want us to give you credit for having got it started. And they certainly did want the credit, so we published a book. And the first chapter is a kind of a summary of the whole thing, plus quite a bit of time on the growth of energy. And it's what made the book readable. The first chapter got you interested in the rest of it.
And at the end of that first chapter, you stated the fact that no comments have been made on whether man's appetite for energy should be whetted or curbed does not mean that no views are held on the subject. Do you wish to comment on that statement?
Well, yes, I had at that time the feeling that growth was a grand thing, but growth in competence, growth in quality, rather than in quantity, is the better growth. And in a finite world, it's almost the necessary better growth. Our energy consumption had been increasing, and if you thought for a moment that the rest of the world deserved to spend energy at a per capita rate of the United States, there just wasn't that much energy to go around. And the rest of the world's increase, of course, has gone up. The rest of the world has grown in energy far more than the United States since that period, which had to be the case. We misguessed in the magnitude of the growth. I guessed that the growth at a high rate would continue for some time. I felt that we could profitably grow, but not forever. We could grow for a while. That our underprivileged could be cured more by improving the economy than by doles to them. The way to help everybody is to have a more viable economy, and the way to do that is to use energy. But I decided that any philosophical comments were maybe not appropriate there, because they man's view is pretty short. You can't be right about things for a very long time, I don't think.
A year later, you wrote the following, 1972, improved energy conversion and utilization need not await such exotic technology as breeder reactors, magnetohydrodynamics, and nuclear fusion. More conventional engineering development holds significant promise for the near term.
Well, there has been more improvement in the efficiency of use of energy than I had said it. In one paper somewhere, I dug out the rate of improvement in energy consumption, such things as passenger miles per ton of coal, or tons of steel per ton of coke in a blast furnace, various measures of how well you're using your energy. and particularly the energy consumption of a producing company, of a manufacturing company, as a fraction of its of the value of its output. And there have been higher improvements in that area than the early evidence of what you could expect causes you to believe. We have not yet gone to any real extent to the combined cycle gas turbine followed by a waste heat steam boiler on a steam turbine. That's been on the ragged edge of going for some years. I don't think either Westinghouse or Pratt & Whitney have sold any combined cycle things. Westinghouse had literature on the combined cycle. I've kind of lost track of what's happened there, but the combined cycle, which would benefit greatly from being able to raise the temperature at inlet to the turbine, looked to me when we wrote the book as though it was the thing we were going to be relying on. And if I'd had to guess in 1972 when the book came out, I would have said that by 1985 there would be a very large use of the combined cycle. And I still think it's coming, but it hasn't. Anything that raises the temperature of the inlet, anything that improves the turbine blades, is a great help. And we still have this chance of making reinforced carbon blades. And there's talk of ceramic parts to engines and turbines, and extruded ceramic heat exchangers are now being offered on the market. I think we'll raise the temperature that we can do air preheat with or run gas turbines with. Any high temperature furnace today has to worry a little bit about whether the gases leaving the furnace aren't just too much to use to heat exchange on air. So they use a regenerator, which is a relatively poor heat exchange device. And I don't know what the gas turbine inlet temperature is now on industrial gas turbines. It's probably not more than 100 degrees higher than it was when we wrote the book, but I still think it's going to come up. Military gas turbines, of course, are very much higher temperature. They can afford more expensive alloys.
At one point, there was an attempt to make a gas turbine engine for an automobile. Chrysler, I believe.
Yes, there are more than one. Chrysler and Ford and General Motors all spent money on gas turbines. And one day, what was it, about 1973 or 4, Roger Babson, of the founder of the Babson Statistical Institute, now called, I think, Babson University, and the purveyor of an advisory service on stock market The Babson curve was one of the curves of the 1920s and 30s, and I was very familiar with it. Well, Robser Babson was an MIT graduate. One of his specialties was buying diamonds. That was one of the ways he figured you could make money. Well, Roger Babson came in to MIT one day hunting for some advice on backing a company on a gas turbine automobile development, and he was sent to me. And I talked with him, for an hour or so, and told him that the company that he wanted to back was a glorified tinsmith place, and gas turbines needed the most sophisticated fluid mechanics specialists to design the blades right, and the chance that this little company could get anywhere in competition with three big companies that were all set to make a lot out of it if it was a good idea was just negligible, and that he should not put one cent into any such venture. It was a great mistake. He took my advice and asked what I wanted, and I said it was fun talking with him. I wasn't charging him anything. A few weeks later, my wife got a check from him. Not an awfully big one, but a nice check. It was, I remember it, because it was on a special check paper that was built around some little town in Florida that Babson practically owned. And the details of that town were part of the check's fancy work.
I'm just going to...
Now,